Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's June 21st, longest day of the year, first day of summer. Time to break out the flip-flops, sunblock, beach chairs, hammock, and think about what to read this summer. Whether you're on vacation or kicking back for a lazy afternoon in the backyard, my guests today will help you navigate what's out there, what's waiting for your imagination. This hour on Point, Summer Reads 2010. You can join the conversation. What's on your short list this summer? Is it a good year? What are you recommending to friends for their book bag, their download? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Let us know what you're reading, what you're recommending. We've got three great readers with us today. From Los Angeles is Mark Sarvis, host of the literary blog The Elegant Variation, author of Harry Revised. Mark, welcome.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Great. It's great to have you with us. From St. Louis on the mighty Mississippi, Jane Henderson is with us, book editor at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Hi, Jane. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
And from Spokane, Washington, Chris O'Hara joins us. She's owner of Auntie's Bookstore on the corner of Washington and Maine in Spokane. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
Hello. Jane, let us come first to you in St. Louis. Give us a few off the top of your list this summer. What have you got, Jane?
Well, one of my picks is Pearl Buck in China, a biography of an author. And you don't have to have read Pearl Buck or really know anything about her to find this book interesting, because her whole life was just fascinating. So she has been sort of forgotten as a woman writer. She was the first American woman to win the Nobel Prize for Literature. But her life is just so interesting, it doesn't really matter if you've read anything by her.
American missionary family in China, when China was in real turmoil, wrote, The Good Earth, that whole trilogy. But this is not her work. This is a book about her pretty remarkable life.
Right, by Hilary Sperling, a biographer. And she wants to show sort of how she came to the Good Earth, how she became a storyteller, and sort of the difference that made in American perception of the Chinese peasants of the time.
And maybe this summer, an amazing measure of how far China has also come. Mark, what's at the top of your list, sir?
Well, the book that I'm finding almost sort of unreasonably entertaining is Christopher Hitchens' memoir, Hitch 22.
Yeah.
And it's definitely, I think it's as close to ideal summer reading as you can get. It's smart, it's funny, it's very engaging. For those who follow Hitchens with any regularity,
the great contrarian.
Yes, and one of the things that can be a little bit annoying about his public persona is his occasionally unendurable self-regard.
Yes.
But in a memoir really sort of calls for that kind of thing. And so all at once, all of these mannerisms of Hitch's that can drive one crazy out in Vanity Fair seem extremely appropriate between the covers of his memoir.
He's all over the world. He's all over the world of big people and big names, and all over the world of big ideas.
That's right. He ranges from, you know, the hot spots from Cuba to Prague. But he also, it's really, I find it most moving as a real dedicated portrait of friendship. You know, it's been sort of called a love letter to Martin Amis, a love letter to Salman Rushdie, and these friendships are really brought to life in this book.
It looks very rich indeed. You've also got Charlie Smith at the top of your list, and Three Delays. Introduce us.
Well, yeah, Charlie Smith was one of those happy surprises that comes across my desk as a blogger. Apparently this is his first novel in 14 years, and he's got quite the following. The book comes, you know, recommended by the likes of Rick Moody and Laurie Moore, and I have to confess I was ignorant of his previous work, but I picked it up, started thumbing through it, and it's one of those books that really does grab you by the throat. It takes off like a rocket ship. He's got he's got this vivid, energetic prose style. He's very funny. He's very smart.
And love story, a rough love story here with former child preacher and the woman that he, they always want to love each other, but they just about kill each other.
Yes, it's, you know, gives whole new meaning to the word star-crossed lovers. You know, these are people we're not entirely sure they're really meant to be, and yet simultaneously could really only be for one another. It's very funny and very moving and not a little disturbing at turns.
Smugglers, boats, and stints in jail and fistfights and plenty of drugs in three delays from Charlie Smith. Speaking of rough stuff, Chris O'Hara in Spokane, you've got The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, that whole trilogy, A Girl Who Played with Fire, A Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest. A lot of people will have read that already, but I suppose this summer means a whole new wave of Stieg Larsson fans.
I keep thinking that everybody has read those books by now, but they just keep flying off the shelf. And with the publication of the third one in the trilogy, there's no end in sight. And they're just perfect, I think, summer reads. A little harder to get into the first one. I was a little surprised when I picked them up because I was expecting a mystery that I would just jump right into and love. Mm-hmm. And it took me a little bit to get into it, but then you're hooked.
I mean, there is rugged violence in these, S and M and every, abbreviation you want to put on it. What about that? Does it work for everybody? Do people look past that? Is there some bigger picture that carries them along, Chris?
I've been surprised because people do not seem to be – they comment on it, but they don't seem real bothered by it. I mean, it doesn't stop their enjoyment from the book. I think that with the current world that we live in, that they're kind of used to that sort of thing. And it is a mystery, and it's a violent world out there.
Chris, take us into another one near the top of your list by Jamie Ford, who I don't know, but this is Hotel on the Corner of Bitter and Sweet. Tell us about it.
It's an absolutely lovely book, and he was in the store recently giving a reading, and just a delightful person. And it's set after World War II. It's a conflict between not only generations but cultures. A young Chinese American in love with a Japanese American, and their love and what happens. And it's just a beautifully written book.
Hotel on the Corner of Bitter and Sweet by Jamie Ford. Our listeners have suggestions. Let's listen to them as well. Ellington, Connecticut. Tony, you're on the air, Tony.
Hi.
Hi.
Tom, I'd like to make a couple of recommendations. I'm the president of the Connecticut chapter of the Romance Writers of America.
Oh, great.
It seems to me that no discussion of hot summer books would be complete without at least mentioning the romance novel.
All right. Take us in.
And I have a couple of recommendations I'd like to make of books that are quite different than what many of your listeners may think of when they hear the term romance novel.
Yeah, how do you define it? What does it mean?
Well, a romance novel just means that it has to have a central love story and that the ending needs to be optimistic and have at least the promise of a possibility of a continuing relationship, what we call the happily ever after.
Is there going to be a bare breast or bare chest on the cover? Is that required?
A clinch cover is what we call those in the industry. The books that I'm going to recommend do not have clinch covers.
Okay.
But, those are still very popular.
Yes. So what are you recommending?
Well, first I'd like to recommend a book by an author who's fairly new to the romance writing scene. Her name's Kristen Higgins, and her first book just came out in 2006, but her very second book won the most prestigious award in women's fiction, which is the Rita Award. Right now on the shelf, she's got a book out called The Next Best Thing, and her books are about contemporary, the romantic comedies featuring working-class people in small-town America, so readers can really relate to these characters, and they're funny, they're quirky, and they're beautifully written.
The Next Best Thing by Kristen Higgins. And give us one more, Tony.
Okay, I'd like to recommend a series, actually, by Jessica Anderson for those people who would rather have a little danger and action with their romance. And she's written a series called The Novels of the Final Prophecy about the end of the world Mayan calendar in December 2012.
Oh, yeah.
People that are fighting to prevent that.
Right.
And the fourth book in that series is called Demon Keepers. That's on the shelves right now.
Tony, thanks for your recommendations. Jane, what do you say to Tony's assertion that, you can't have summer reading list without some romance or two on it?
A lot of people love romance. Women love romance. And, I think people should read what they like. Read about what they like. This is supposed to be fun. So I say pick something that you're going to love. But some of the literary novelists, they don't really have that happily ever after ending. So they do focus on relationships, which people love to read about, but they don't always have the happily ever after.
You've got a couple on your list, one from Jane Smiley, Private right. Life, and another from right. Vendela Vida, The Lovers. Tell us about those.
Right. Those are both sort of what I just mentioned. Mm-hmm. They're books about women and their families, their intimate portraits, but they're not necessarily happily ever after. In fact, Jane Smiley's book, I picked out because, I mean, she is one of the best writers in America, I think, and this may not be her very best book, but it's still a fascinating portrait. It's got history. It's got families.
I read 10 Days in the Hills a couple of years back, but this one is about a bad marriage, I guess.
Right, sort of a bad marriage. It's a woman who is getting on in years. She lives in rural Missouri, where and she, in fact, was inspired by Smiley's great aunt. And we don't think of Smiley as writing memoir, but she was inspired by some actual relatives. And she marries this man because at 27, she sort of figures she's probably not going to have another chance. And they move to California. And he's sort of an eccentric astronomer who is convinced that he's a genius and that the world will recognize his genius. But the world never really does.
And she realizes she's married maybe a madman.
Right, that's exactly right. He is a quirky guy, and he's based again on Smiley's great uncle, who was sort of the same and hated Albert Einstein and wrote vicious things about how Albert Einstein was wrong.
Who has the time to hate Albert Einstein? We may get you to read a bit of that, but just mention The Lovers, Vendela Vida. This is set in Turkey.
Oh yeah. This is a widow who has dealt with the grief of the loss of her husband, and she has two children, and she goes to Turkey to sort of where she had her honeymoon and to try to work through her grief.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour on the first day of summer, longest day of the year, June 21st, about summer books, summer reads. 2010, Jane Henderson is with us. She's book editor at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, joins us from St. Louis. Chris O'Hara is here from Auntie's Bookstore in Spokane, Washington, joins us from Spokane Corner of Washington in Maine. And Mark Sarvis is with us from Los Angeles. He's host of the literary blog The Elegant Variation, author of Harry Revised. Mark Sarvis, read us just a little bit of Christopher Hitchens, if you would, in his memoir, Hitch 22.
Sure, I'm happy to, Tom. This is a section that occurs when he has the good fortune to meet Ms. Margaret Thatcher. And, who he's called sexy to the consternation of his colleagues on the left.
Right.
And I'll just sort of let events speak for themselves
okay.
here. So within moments, Margaret Thatcher and I were face to face. Within moments, too, I had turned away and was showing her my rear. I suppose that I must have given some sort of explanation for this. Almost as soon as we shook hands on immediate introduction, I felt that she knew my name and had perhaps connected it to the Socialist Weekly that had recently called her rather sexy. While she struggled adorably with this moment of pretty confusion, I felt obliged to seek controversy and picked a fight with her on a detail of Rhodesia-Zimbabwe policy. She took me up on it. I was, as it chances, right on the small point of fact, and she was wrong. But she maintained her wrongness with such adamantine strength that I eventually conceded the point and even bowed slightly to emphasize my acknowledgement. No, she said, bow lower. Smiling agreeably, I bent a bit farther. No, no, she trilled, much lower. By this time, a little group of interested bystanders was gathering. I again bent forward, this time much more self-consciously. Stepping around behind me, she unmasked her batteries and smote me on the rear with the parliamentary order paper that she had been rolling into a cylinder behind her back. I regained the vertical with some awkwardness. As she walked away, she looked back over her shoulder and gave an almost imperceptibly slight roll of the hip while mouthing the words, "Naughty boy."
Spanked by Margaret Thatcher, that's got to be a particularly English pleasure,
yeah,
I guess.
I don't think really any of us will ever get to claim that particular pleasure.
Well, if you haven't got it already, you won't get it now. That's from Hitch 22 by Christopher Hitchens. Jane, you've got a little something from, I don't know, from Pearl Buck in China. Can we hear a little of that?
Sure, of course. This is when Pearl was very young, probably like around 1890s. and the hill behind her house had a graveyard. So she
in China, I assume.
In China, mm-hmm. yes. And she was born in the United States but moved to China young. Mm-hmm. And her she was sort of was like a funeral crasher. She was an enthusiastic participant in local funerals on the hill outside the walled compound of her parents' house. Large, noisy, convivial affairs where everyone had a good time. Pearl joined in as soon as the party got going, with people killing cocks, burning paper money, and gossiping about foreigners making malaria pills out of babies' eyes. "Everything you say is lies," I remarked pleasantly. There was always a moment of strained silence. Did they or did they not understand what I had said? They asked each other. They understood, but could not believe they had. The unexpected apparition of a small American girl squatting in the grass and talking intelligibly, unlike other Westerners, seemed magical, if not demonic.
Oh, wow. Wonderful. Jane Henderson reading from A Pearl Buck in China by Hilary Sperling. And Chris O'Hara at Auntie's Bookstore, you've got The Housekeeper and the Professor by Yoko Ogawa on your list. Tell us about it and maybe give us a little read.
This is a delightful book that my book group read, and I had never heard of it before, and I was absolutely dazzled by the writing. It's just a beautiful book, a very simple, very calming book, and a simple story of an older gentleman who is unable to live on his own anymore, and his sister hires housekeepers to help him out. But, however, his situation is a little different. He has no memory other than for 85, I think it's 85 minutes, and he can only remember that long.
Right. So the housekeeper must reintroduce herself every morning.
That's right. And so everything that happens in his life, he forgets, and it has to be. So every morning, as you say, she reintroduces herself. And it's a delightful description in the book, too, of when he has little pieces of paper all over himself that he attaches to him, remind himself of things that happened during the day. And so he's got these little pieces of paper stuck all over his hands and his arms and his chest and just to remind himself.
Let's have a read.
Okay, this is when the housekeeper, they are never named in the book, by the way, the housekeeper and the professor, the housekeeper is being interviewed by the man's sister before, and the sister is telling this woman, this is what the job is going to be like. She's describing the professor. He has difficulties with his memory, she said. He's not senile. His brain works well. But about 17 years ago, he hit his head in an automobile accident. Since then, he has been unable to remember anything new. His memory stops in 1975. He can remember a theorem he developed 30 years ago, but he has no idea what he ate for dinner last night. In the simplest terms, it is as if he has a single 80-minute videotape inside his head, and when he records anything new, he has to record over the existing memories. His memory lasts precisely 80 minutes.
Wow.
No more, no less.
No more.
Fascinating book.
The Housekeeper and the Professor by Yoko Ogawa. We've got a lot more on your list, but our listeners have lists of their own. Fort Myers, Florida. Mary, you're on the air. Hello, Mary. Are you there? Oh, Mary must have gotten lost in her book. We'll go to Nashville, Tennessee, and William. William, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, I guess what I've got, I actually have three books on my shelf right now by John Swartzwelder, who is the writer of 59 Simpsons episodes.
Okay, so they must be funny then.
He's really, really funny. I think he's by far the most prolific Simpsons writers, and there's some pretty good guys that have been through those rooms.
No kidding. So what's he got on the bookshelf, William?
Well, I guess my recommendation was double wonderful because that's one I've already read. Also, one called The Time Machine Did It. So the titles kind of give you an idea where he's coming from.
Does it feel like you're reading a Simpsons episode? Is it that kind of humor?
It is a little bit, yeah. It's absurdist. He is not particularly tied to any particular reality. You know, those guys talk about flexible reality or rubber band reality where things are going along in, you know, kind of a sensible way for a while. And then when it sort of suits their purposes, they just go into some, you know, kind of other absurdist dimension. But it's really just for laughs. It's just, but he's so funny. I mean, I actually laugh out loud reading these books.
John Swartzwelder and Double Wonderful. Do you need, is comedy a prerequisite for your summer reading list, William?
I think so. Yeah.
Got to have a good laugh. I see another one from Carl Hyacin this summer, Star Island. I don't know. Mark, do you know anything about it?
I don't. I only know Carl Hyacin by reputation, but I don't read a lot of his books, unfortunately.
I see here he's bringing back some characters from Stormy Weather and Double Whammy. I mean, they are funny. If you go for Hyacin, he brings on the humor. It's nice to have some of that in a summer list. Let's go to Virginia Beach. Virginia, Sherry, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm an English major, so I read all the time, and,
great,
you know, I've read all the classics, but I want to recommend a book by Christopher Moore called Fool, and I guess we're all into the comedy because he is hilarious, and this is a conception of King Lear from the point of view of the fool whose name is Pocket and who's raised in dog snogging by nuns, and, I mean, it just... It's so funny to turn a tragedy like that into something. The fool is, of course, the most brilliant character in the book.
Christopher Moore and Fool. He wrote Lamb as well.
Lamb, and I was going to recommend Lamb. Lamb is just hilarious. The full title of the book is Lamb, The Gospel According to Biff, Christ's Childhood Pal.
Oh, boy.
And he conceives of Jesus' childhood in a hilarious way, because nobody knows what the childhood was about, and Biff is his best friend, who's always trying to keep him out of trouble from the Pharisees.
Sounds like it's good to get out there on the humor front. What in history, in scripture, you name it. Let me get another one right here. Thank you, Sherry. Let's go to Barbara in Rehoboth, Massachusetts. Barbara, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just finished this book, and it's one of the best I've ever read. It's Ant Hill by E.O. Wilson, his new book. Just a beautifully written chronicle of sort of his life, as well as the environment and his obviously his love of the natural world. And it.
But this is his foray into fiction, right? The great E.O.
Yes.
Wilson, Ant Master, going into literature, fiction for the first time.
Yes, and anyone who has an interest in the natural world, whether it be a young adult or an adult, it's a great read. One of the most, the center section called the Ant Hill Chronicles is one of the most incredibly written from the point of an ant.
And what do you say to E.O. Wilson? Should he stick with fiction? Should he do some more? This is not exactly his first time out as a writer. He's lauded all over the place for his memoirs and work on the natural world. Does he carry it off in fiction?
I think he does, and I've read most all of his work, and I have to say I heard him on BUR talking about the problems with creating dialogue, and this is a modern-day Huckleberry Finn. It's a wonderful book, a great adventure, a great delving into environmental education and all sorts of things, but I highly recommend it. It's just a wonderful book, not romance, not some hot novel, but a wonderful book and something to really imbue you with a sense of the natural world and ants.
Terrific. We'll take it. E.O. Wilson's Ant Hill. Thank you very much, Barbara, for calling. Mark, maybe you've got a reading you could do for us that sort of harkens back to Tocqueville and a different era in this country from Peter Carey.
Yes, you'd be talking about Peter Carey's new novel, Parrot and Olivier in America. And for those of us who are fans of Peter Carey, it is really a novel that is reminiscent of the Peter Carey who won the Booker Prize for Oscar and Lucinda, and the Kelly Gang. It's a big, sprawling, very funny, very lively tale that is essentially a fictionalized rendering of de Tocqueville's trip through America. And this is a scene, a moment from very, very early in the book where he is... he's being taught to swim by one of his caretakers at the family estate.
Before he leaves France, before he even comes to the States, or
before all the revolutions have swept Paris and he is set off on his way. He's just a young boy here.
Okay,
but he says, "I was a strange small creature for him to love. He was a strong, handsome man with snow-white hair and shrewd eyes, easily moved to sympathy. He had raised my father, and now I trusted myself entire to him, his big liver-spotted hands, his patient manner, the smell of Virginia tobacco which stained the shoulder of his cassock and filled me with the atoms of America 20 years before I breathed its air. "Come, young man," he would say, "it's a beautiful day, decorous et dies," and the hail would be likely flailing your back raw, and he would marvel not at the cruel pummeling, but at the miracle of ice, or not of the ice, then the wind, blowing so violently it seemed the North Sea itself was pushing up the Seine and would wash away the wall that separated the river from the Bam. The meek would not swim, but Bebe made sure I was not meek.
That's some very promising writing. What's his take on this? It's the Olivier character that I guess is sort of our near de Tocqueville, and who's the parrot character in Parrot and Olivier in America?
The parrot is his sidekick, who is also based on a historical figure, but is much more liberally reinvented in this particular tale. And he's definitely his sort of his Boswell and his right hand. And it's funny, the partnership between these two actually reminded me a little bit of the friendship in the only novel that Tom Stoppard wrote, Lord Malquist and Mr. Moon. And there's a very similar relationship between the royal master and the servant. The dynamic is very comic, and he uses it to great effect.
Tell us about another one you've got on your list, Mark, The Ask by Sam Lipsitt.
Sam Lipsitt is a brilliant comic novelist, you know, for those who are talking about wanting humor in their summer reads. This is one, and it's the follow-up to his last novel was a book called Homeland that was embraced and beloved by bloggers, and Sam sort of specializes in writing these over-educated but underachieving, sort of perhaps just post-baby boomer near-do-wells. And the narrator Milo of this book is a guy whose job is basically working for a university, hitting up rich patrons for donations, and he's been fired because he's not very good at it. He's not very good at most of the things that he does, but he's been given one opportunity to get his job back by going out there and getting a big, as they call it, a big ask. There's a donor that they've targeted, and they want Milo to go out and get the big donation from him. And to get that donation, he has to do some strange and interesting things on behalf of this donor.
Okay, we know, well, we can only imagine where that might go. That's The Ask by Sam Lipsitt, which gets a big thumbs up from Mark Sarvis. Here's some from Facebook. Let's see. Cynthia's reading The Lonely Polygamist by Brady Udall. That's kind of a built-in challenge there. Blythe is going through the pages of history, the Confessions of St. Augustine, A Midsummer Night's Dream, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And here's a post at the website from Elizabeth saying, "My fiancé and I heard Amy Bender read from her new novel, The Particular Sadness of Lemon Cake, I guess, last week. She says, we've been reading it aloud to each other and we're hooked. Yesterday we read for 3 hours straight." Dear panel, have you read it? It's getting some notice, The Particular Sadness of Lemon Cake. Chris, Jane, have you read?
I haven't read it yet, Tom, but I am very interested in that. I sent it out for review, and I'm hoping to hear back soon. I think that it's probably going to be a really interesting book.
This is the one, I think, where the emotions of the baker end up tasted in the goods, if I've read correctly. Let's get Mary in Fort Myers. I think she's back to us. Mary, you're on the air. Fort Myers, Florida. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well.
Well, I have to admit, I'm kind of a slave to the bestsellers list, and two books that I've read this spring, summer, that I just adored, that were opposites of each other. One is a fellow that I heard interviewed on your radio station, and it prompted me to read the book, and that's Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Slayer.
Okay.
It's just an extraordinary book. It's Lincoln's life, and largely has a lot of the historical context that we all understand. But the backdrop to it is that his real goal was to rid America of vampires.
We didn't steer you wrong then with that, Mary. You liked it all right. And what's your second?
The second is a political look behind the scenes at the 2008 election cycle, and it's called Game Change.
Oh, Mark Halperin, yeah. Yeah, oh, we're out of time at the break here, Mary, but I appreciate your call. There's politics and vampires and Abe Lincoln all. We're talking about Summer Reads 2010. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about summer books, summer reads for 2010, whether they're new or golden oldies that have been brought back maybe from your shelf. Jane Henderson is with us. She's book editor at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Mark Sarvis is here from L.A., host of the literary blog The Elegant Variation. And from Spokane, Washington, corner of South Washington and Maine, Chris O'Hara is here. She's owner of Auntie's Bookstore in Spokane. Chris, you've got a reading from something I hadn't heard of, The Sweetness at the Bottom of the Pie by Alan Bradley. Tell us about it.
Oh, it's a great book. Perfect summer reading. It's kind of a quirky little thing, and in fact, it kind of reminded me of the Charles Adams cartoons, if you remember them. And it's the story, it's a mystery, and the story of a young girl who is kind of different. And she lives in a great big old house, and the family is one of those unusual kind of families that don't encounter too often. At least you don't encounter them in Spokane, Washington. And she gets involved in a murder.
This is an 11-year-old sort of girl detective with Flavia Deluce, in a 1950s English village, I think the big old house is set.
Uh-huh, you've got it right. And she, of course, is kind of eccentric and is going to investigate and find out what's going on. And the voice is just absolutely wonderful, this 11-year-old, just pitch perfect. And she's interested in poison, by the way, and is trying to poison her sister at the same time that she's out there solving a mystery.
Okay, let's hear something.
Okay, this is the, let me find the passage.
I know there's a stamp gets stolen in this book. A stranger ends up dead in a cucumber bed.
That's the kind of book it is. I mean, the cucumber bed is particularly a nice touch. And there's a dead starling with the postage stamp is affixed to its beak when it is found in the cucumber patch.
Oh, boy.
And this is where she's kind of describing some of her special abilities, Flavia is. And she says, "It's a simple fact of nature that I happen to possess acute hearing, the kind of hearing, Father once told me, which allows its owner to hear spider webs clanging like horseshoes against the walls. Harriet had possessed it too, and sometimes I like to imagine that I am in a way a rather odd remnant of her, a pair of disembodied ears, drifting round the haunted halls of Buckshaw, hearing things that are sometimes better left unheard." And that's the kind of young woman she is.
The Sweetness at the Bottom of the Pie. It's a debut also by the Canadian journalist Alan Bradley. Let's get a call from Newburyport, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
I'm okay. What are you reading?
Well, I just finished the original Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, and I thought it was really tremendous with all the sort of monster mania out there with vampires and werewolves and whatnot. I thought I'd get back to one of the original Gothic stories, and I thought it was amazing. It was so timely. It sort of spoke to so many of our issues today in terms of, you know, our love for science and wanting to kind of play God. It's a great story. I really recommend it to anyone from, you know, eighth graders reading Twilight to 80-year-olds studying, you know, or engrossed in fine literature. It's really just one of those crossover books.
That's good. John, it's so long since I've read it. It remind me of the language. Will an eighth grader who is reading Twilight be able to plunge into Mary Shelley?
It's a little, you know, it's a little stiff, but surprisingly readable. I think people should give it a shot because it's so descriptive, and you know, it also, I think if you read it knowing it was written by an 18-year-old woman, it's astounding how erudite it really is as a story. Yet it can be read as a popular story as well.
John's going old school there with Mary Shelley's Frankenstein in the new age of vampires and everything else. John, thank you. Jane, what's your what do you make of the? I mean, there's a big one. Is it Passage or The Passage or something? A huge vampire book again this summer. Is there no end to the, you know, vampire monster love in our reading culture?
There's no end to it, Tom. It's going to keep coming. It's going to keep coming. I think there is a little vampire fatigue right now. I think some people are rebelling against it, but there's going to continue to be new stories. And the Cronin's book, the what's his name, Justin Cronin, The Passage. Mm. That is expected to be a big book. It's expected to be made into a movie. There's two more books coming. He's apparently a very good writer. Our reviewer really liked it. It's long, but people who like to go into different worlds and who like a little extra to their stories, you know, a little paranormal something, should like it, yeah.
You've got a reading. You mentioned Jane Smiley's private life earlier. Could you give us a little sampling of that, Jane?
Sure. This is the opposite of the vampire. This is the quiet life, you know, the sort of ordinary lives that people who like, you know, more excitement in their reading probably don't always read, but she says so much in just a few, you know, simple sentences. This is when Margaret, the woman, is
in the frustrated marriage.
Right, who's
to the
going
sort of crazy scientist.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And she's just married, and so they're just going to be leaving to go to California. And her mother's name is Lavinia. Mm. Lavinia told Margaret when she left Missouri, "You've always been a good girl, and now you've had a piece of luck, marrying at 27. But a wife only has to do as she's told for the first year." Since one of the things she was told to do was to have marital relations, when she and Andrew embarked upon the sleeper that carried them across the enormous western lands to California, she expected, as Beatrice had warned her, that marital relations would commence at once, but they did not. Andrew was too tall for the sleeper and too modest. He felt they should have separate berths. However, he gave her a chaste kiss every morning upon rising and every evening just before he retired.
Mm, we can already hear that kind of slow, deep tempo you're describing right there.
Right.
In the train car. But no marital relations on the way
no
to California.
No marital relations.
Let's get a call from the way to California. Salt Lake City, Utah. Miriam. Miriam, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I had two questions. Mm-hmm. I've had one of three surgeries. I've got two more coming up.
Oh, boy.
And I have not been able to just read a book. Pain meds do something to your brains.
Right.
So what I have found are short stories have been okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if they could recommend any collections of short stories. And also, is there any way that you could post all these titles maybe on your Facebook page for those of us who have no memory left?
We absolutely
for 80
will.
80 minutes.
Okay. Right. We wish you luck with each and every one of those. We hope they fly by beautifully, those surgeries, Miriam. And yes, we have the full list up at the website already. I'm not sure about Facebook, but perhaps there too. But you can get Jane and Chris's and Mark's full list, authors, titles, everything, at our website, onpointradio.org. And as to stories for Miriam, who may not want to read a whole book, Mark, you've got at least one story collection on your list.
That's right. The collection is called Alone With You, and it's the new collection of short stories by Marissa Silver. And Marissa is a justly celebrated short story writer who's contributed to The New Yorker. In fact, her debut short story was published in The New Yorker, so how's that for a great way to start your career?
Not too shabby. I've read these described as eight beautiful and brutal stories.
They are. They're you know, I may be stretching the definition of what people look for in summer reading, but I don't accept the idea that summer reading has to, by definition, be light.
Mm-hmm.
Her stories are, they're deep, they're involved. You know, she really excavates family and relationships and loves and lovers, but they're beautifully written, and each one is so sort of a crystal clean, clear. The prose, her characters are wonderfully realized. That I recommend it to anyone who's really interested in what's going on in the short story today. I think should be reading her stories.
Alone With You by Marissa Silver. You know what might work for Miriam as well? You've got a collection of poems that you're recommending for the summer. Edward Hirsch's The Living Fire. Tell us about it.
I do. I think that it's a wonderful way to, you know, spend a summer afternoon sitting, mm-hmm, and you know, flipping through a poetry collection. And Hirsch is the author of something like six or seven, I think, collections of poetry. And he's actually wrote one of the best introductions to poetry that I've ever read. It's called How to Read a Poem and Fall in Love with Poetry. And I think in one volume, he was largely responsible for my poetry education. But he's also been a He has received the National Book Critics Circle Award and a MacArthur Fellowship. And this, The Living Fire, is actually, it's a collection of some of his selected poems from throughout his career, in addition to some new poems of his. And one of the collections that he quotes from is called Special Orders, and it really is a volume that reflects on his relationship with his father. And I don't know if you're inviting me to
read
a little
bit. Oh, if you've
got
a little bit, sure.
Yeah, there's a very short poem. It's the title poem from Special Orders.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll I'm not a poet, obviously. I'll do my best to read it well. But
Edward Hirsch, we'll listen.
Edward Hirsch. Give me back my father walking the halls of Wertheimer Box and Paper Company with sawdust clinging to his shoes. Give me back his tape measure and his keys, his drafting pencil and his order forms. Give me his daydreams on lined paper. I don't understand this uncontainable grief. Whatever you had that never fit, whatever else you needed, believe me, my father, who wanted your business, would squat down at your side and sketch you a container for it.
That's great.
And that's, in fact, what his father did. His father was in the business of making boxes and packaging in containers.
With the sawdust on his pant leg. The Living Fire from Edward Hirsch. Thanks for that reading. Let's go to Phil. He's on U.S. 64 East in Arkansas. A big rig maybe there. Hi, Phil. You're on the air.
Well, hello, Tom.
Hi.
Three things that I have found wonderful. The Big Short, which came out earlier this year, I found enthralling and just very easy to read for the subject matter.
Michael Lewis, if you want to know what's really been going on in the money world, the high finance world, absolutely.
Right. I just finished rereading To Kill a Mockingbird for, I don't know, the dozenth time, and it was wonderful again.
So true.
A novel that came out several years ago by Larry McMurtry called Leaving Cheyenne.
Takes
you through the whole gambit of emotions from crying to laughing. It's just a wonderful book. And if you've never read it, you should. It is just, I don't know how much time we have here, but it's told in three parts by three different people. One, while these people are in their young life, the middle part of their lives, their middle age life, is told by the woman in the book, and then the third part is told by another male character in their old age, and it is just absolutely wonderful.
Larry McMurtry rarely fails. Phil, tell us, you know, I mean, you're driving the truck. When do you do your reading? When we see your rig pulled over, you know, at a rest stop at night, are you in there with Larry McMurtry and To Kill a Mockingbird and all the rest, or is that safe for home or what?
No, I generally, whenever, you know, the law says we can only drive for 11 hours a day, so whenever I pull over, and if I'm not too tired, I try and keep some reading material in here. So,
well, it sounds like you've got a pretty good stash there. Anybody would be lucky to read it. Thank you for your recommendations, Phil. Our time is getting short. Venice, Florida. Lisa, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Yeah.
The book I'd like to share is called Ay Caramba, and it's magic realism, and it was written by a woman who actually was running a flea market in California. So I cannot remember her name, and I apologize for that, but the plot is really interesting. It involves two best friends who are in their early 20s, I would say. Everybody in this small town works in a cheese factory, and the one girl's father was killed when she was younger by a train because he was sitting on the train tracks drunk, and he comes back and haunts everyone. And so her best friend decides to go down to Mexico and make things right in order so that his soul can rest. But it gets so much more detailed than that, and I don't have that much time, but it really is interesting. It may sound cheesy, and it is a little bit, but it is so much fun.
Lisa, we'll take that. It's summertime. Ay Caramba is the recommendation right there, and thank you very much for that. Jane, give us a couple more off your list. We're running out of time here. What can you recommend?
Well, I really liked the diversity, sort of the eclecticism of that Phil's list.
Yeah.
So I added a couple of things that aren't really on here because of the prose, and they're not novels, they're nonfiction. Mm-hmm. One is coming out in a month, Off the Grid by Nick Rosen, and he talks to all kinds of people who are trying to be more self-sufficient. There's a lot of books coming out about that.
As in living off the grid.
Off the grid. Mm-hmm. Some of them they're doing it for different reasons. Mm-hmm. Some are religious, some are because they don't like the government, some are environmental. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he actually gives a nice little survey, and he doesn't sugarcoat things. I mean, he seems to approve of their lifestyle. One guy lives in or sleeps sometimes in one of these 24-hour storage units that he rents, and you're not allowed to sleep in them, but a few people apparently do.
Not exactly, but Walden Pond.
No, it's not Walden Pond, but he seems to approve of it. He seems to think that this is an option. Yet, at the same time, he doesn't sugarcoat things.
And I see Twain's Feast all the way down here.
Right. This is a new book just out, like, I think this week or last week. I haven't actually read this, but I think it sounds fascinating. As we know, Twain's 100th anniversary of his death is mm-hmm. this year. Mm-hmm. So anything by or about Twain is appropriate, as it always is. But Twain's Feast is about foods that Twain listed, 100 years ago, that when he was living in Europe, that he missed in America. And so the author, Andrew Beers, I guess his name is pronounced, mm-hmm. talks about sort of changing food culture, what we liked 100 years ago, how this has changed.
He's got prairie chickens and on
prairie
there and
chickens,
raccoon
right.
supper.
Right.
And Mark Twain lived when we ate it all, I guess.
That's exactly right. Canvasback duck from Baltimore, black bass from Mississippi. I don't even know if these things exist anymore.
And let us not forget the ever-popular oyster ice cream.
Oh.
Oh, boy. That's something to cool you down in the backyard for summer. We're not going to get all the way through all of these lists, but it's just great what you've shared with us already. And as I mentioned, the full list from each of my guests today will be up at our website, onpointradio.org. Maya, we're grateful to you for these tips. It is the time, and for all of us lucky enough to hit that hammock soon, this is a great way to be forearmed. Mark Sarvis with The Elegant Variation, joining us from Los Angeles. Mark, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
Chris O'Hara at Auntie's Bookstore in Spokane. Chris, thank you for being here.
It was a delight.
And Jane Henderson at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Thank you, Jane.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.